Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, brand new information that could help millions of people with Lyme's disease. This is the first epidemic of climate change. And the government and private medical industry know this, and yet they're in denial and exhibiting malfeasance about the truth of the epidemic. We will have the world's leading authority on Lyme's disease, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, to discuss this in depth. Also today, new information if you have depression or anxiety, an approach you probably have not tried, with some really remarkable results. Also today, we will be going to our audio clips and playing three. One of those clips will be about, should we be taking sides in the Palestinian and Israeli conflict? This person says no, and he has 60 seconds to make his case. Then we will weigh in, and you'll have an opportunity to share your points of view. Also, we will play a more in-depth piece explaining that when President Trump and American media continue to condemn Hamas, take a step back and realize it was Israel that created Hamas, much like we created the Mujahideen and learned nothing from that. The terrorists, the Islamic extremists that we armed and trained that fought the Russians in Afghanistan, we have now been training and arming and funding the White Helmets, a terrorist organization, but al-Nusra and at least a dozen other terrorist organizations in the Middle East, in Libya and in Syria. What do you think the blowback is going to be from that? Oh, and by the way, over $1 billion of our money went to the terrorists. Now, all those weapons they have, we can't get them back, and we'll play a clip on that. So then now when you look at what's happening in Israel, and you look at who Israel's condemning, at no point does Netanyahu or the others make a claim, we created the monster that is attacking us. We will tell you that story. So we have a lot to share today, plus our schools are collecting information on our children's thoughts and creating a database to see who is the compliant child. Well, hold on. China's doing that now also. They're giving merit to citizens that are completely compliant and obedient to the communist doctrine. What about those that challenge it? Those that do not see eye to eye? Not so good for them. And we're doing something like that in the United States? Yes, we are. So you see, we have a lot of unusual things to share today, and we begin with a study out of Friedrich Alexander University in Germany. And they're showing a strong link between depression and anxiety disorders and autoimmune thyroiditis. That's a chronic thyroid condition affecting approximately 10% of the population, or over 31 million people. Scientists have now proven that special treatment could help many sufferers, especially women. Let me put this in perspective. Depression and anxiety are among the most common disorders across the globe. In fact, in one recent year, there were more than 260,000 patients admitted to hospital for treatment in Germany alone. And that's from the Federal Statistics Office. So together with a group of scientists, and the chair of the psychotherapy and psychiatry departments, they took a look at this, and that's what they found. They also were working through the Max Planck researchers. What does this mean? Let's go back 20 years. 20 years ago, in one of the 40 clinical studies that I conducted, and this one with Dr. Martin Feldman, in fact, Dr. Feldman was in all of them, up until his death, which was 2 years ago. they were all medical supervised tests, clinical studies, but nothing medical was involved, meaning no drugs, no medical applications. They were not told to discontinue any drugs, continue with your medical treatment with your regular doctor, but we implemented a holistic protocol to change their diet behavior through stress management and exercise. This particular one wanted to see, could we manage depression, anxiety, and weight in women specifically? In fact, it was exclusively women, over 400 women, over a six-month period. And the results were phenomenal. What was our protocol? Our protocol was to begin by testing people for thyroiditis, frequently undiagnosed, unrecognized. Let me give you some of these symptoms where a person will start to gain weight, but they won't be eating extra food. They don't know why they're gaining weight. They feel fatigue, especially after they eat a meal, like they want to take a nap. They get tired in the early evening and generally want to go to bed early. That get up and go is gone. They frequently have some thinning of the eyebrows. The outer eyebrows thin. The hair thins. The nails thin. And they're very susceptible to infections. They can go through mood swings. And the two moods they're most commonly affected by are depression and anxiety. So by having all the women be tested, which is a simple saliva test, we found a high percentage had underactive thyroids. And there are many different causes of the thyroid being affected. There can be an infections in the thyroid. There can be inflammation in the thyroid. There can be nutrient deficiencies causing the thyroid to malfunction. So they were put on a diet, and the diet consisted of a lot of sea vegetables, and there are probably 20 different edible sea vegetables, and even showing them how to make them tasty, like washing it and rinsing it three times, and then cooking it at a relatively low temperature for about 3 or 4 minutes, and that gets rid of the rubberiness in a lot of the, like, kombu and wakame, and then chilling it, and then making a relish mustard sauce, and then putting that up, chopping it up and mixing it together, and putting that into stuffed avocados, or putting it into a salad, or making it into a hot dish, like in brown rice, or even into a soup, like a miso seaweed soup. But it was very important to have fermented foods. We found that there's a direct link, let me repeat that, a direct link between an underactive thyroid and the probiotics in your system. So the emphasis was on making sure that they had either took probiotics by capsule or things like beet juice and sauerkraut and miso and other fermented foods. And within that three-month period, we saw remarkable turnarounds. And then we published an article. It was published in the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Physicians. And it's posted up on my website. If you go to prn.fm, then download the article by Dr. Martin Feld and myself on the thyroid gland. Because that was the whole study. We didn't do anything for anything else, meaning no protocols for the heart or brain. No protocols that I would otherwise use for depression and anxiety. That would be a separate study that was done just 2 years ago and was very successful also. So that, when I read this article, and this was with 36,000 participants, and it just kicked back to that 20 years ago. So we were way ahead of the curve, and we did a one-year follow-up in the women who continued to keep all inflammatory items out of their diet, meaning they could have, here's what you cannot have if you want to have a healthy thyroid. Coffee, one of your worst contributors to malfunctioning thyroid. High fructose corn syrup in any form, soft drinks, artificial sweeteners. No meat, dairy, wheat, sugar of any kind, unless it's natural, like coconut sugar or stevia, or honey. A plant-based diet, and an emphasis upon nuts, in particularly walnuts, pine nuts, and pecans. Those are very healthy for you. Olive oil, coconut oil, and flaxseed oil was good. Lots of juices, but not the green juices as much as a special detox juice which contain ginger, 1 ounce, and lemon, 1 ounce, apple cider vinegar, 1 ounce, and then dilute the rest of it with green apple. That was extremely beneficial. Watermelon is terrific for an underactive thyroid, as are all the berries. So that turned off, in effect, the autoimmune thyroiditis. And when you've overstimulated the immune system, you then become more susceptible to a malfunctioning thyroid. So it's widespread, very common, and just information of how to help yourself with a different condition. Now, talking about a plant-based diet, now the Mediterranean diet is principally, in the majority of plant-based diet, they also do have local fish, but it's mainly the beans, the seeds, the whole grains, the vegetables, fruits. And there's also what's called the DASH diet, D-A-S-H. Now they're associated with a lower risk of hearing loss. This is from Brigham and Women's Hospital. And it was published in the Journal of Nutrition. And it shows that this plant-based diet, or the Mediterranean diet, is protective against hearing loss. And this was a large study in women, 81,818 women between 27 and 44 were in the Nurses' Health Study, Part 2, and they followed them for 4 years. So this is important, and it made a big difference. So if you have hearing problems, the plant-based diet. Also at Ohio State University, as well as Utrecht University in the Netherlands, they found a new pig virus, and it could be a potential threat to humans. And it can readily find its way into laboratory-cultured cells of people and other species, and a discovery that raises concerns about the potential for outbreaks that threaten human and animal health. And this was published in the journal PNAS. It was originally discovered in China in pigs in 2014, then in the United States in 2012, and China in 2014 in pigs that had diarrhea and vomiting. And it was fatal in a lot of these pigs. The question is, can a particular emerging virus called the coronavirus, can it end up in humans, and what will be the outcome? If you've ever gone to most restaurants, you don't know, unless it's a kosher restaurant, if they're using one board to cut up pork and then cook it. And how do you know they're cooking at the right temperature or any animal protein? And then they cut your salad on that same one, same board, and you get cross-contamination. How do you know that the chef should be wearing plastic gloves but isn't? And now they pick up an animal protein, and now whatever's not animal protein, viruses, parasites, bacteria, is on their hands, and now they touch the bread or something else that you're eating. It is very, very easy to cross-contaminate. And I just believe that you should stay away from animal proteins altogether, but especially pork and chicken. They're two of the most dangerous that you can be around. So we'll see in the near future, because we don't practice good hygiene in the United States, especially when you're outside. That's why I never eat anything raw outside. Yeah, I'll have something that's been cooked, brown rice, beans, seaweed. But anything else, never. Because I know what goes on in kitchens. I just don't trust that. That's the latest on health and healing. We've got a lot to cover today. Before we take our first break, and we're going to come right out of that first break by listening to Blowback, how Israel went from helping create Hamas to bombing it. It's just 6 minutes long with Joshua Cox, and I think you'll appreciate what is said. But also, I want to encourage you to go to prn.fm. We have a brand new homepage, by the way. And you'll see a list of the most current articles. The three of them are about Wikipedia. In 2 days now, I'll be presenting a brand new original investigative report on plant-based medicine, where we have looked at over 100,000, I repeat, 100,000 studies showing the efficacy, science, chemistry, and benefit of these herbs. And this is going to be held up against the people at Wikipedia who say none of this is anything. Don't trust any herbs. They're worthless. They're wrong. And yet Wikipedia has all the strength and power to influence hundreds of millions of people a day. Well, the only thing we can do is just try to find the truth and get it out through the sources we have. And to help that, if you read the articles, if you agree with what you read and the audio clips of the shows I'm doing, please share them. It only works if you pass it forward as many times as you can. But here's what's important. For years, I chose not to divert my attention from the tasks of exposing corruption that I was finding doing the documentaries. But now I turned around and I face Wikipedia because on there they had a profile of me and it's completely 100% wrong. But they chose, no matter how many times I showed them they were in error, they chose not to change it. That led to an investigation of Wikipedia itself, and that's when we found inside of Wikipedia, we found this group called the Skeptics. And they're the ones who are very pro-pharma, and no matter what evidence you present them with, they will not change. So, now that we know that they're condemning everything in the way of alternative health care, holistic nursing, dentistry, homeopathy, we just did an article on homeopathy in Wikipedia showing they were wrong. Again, we're now exposing everything that they say is bad. We're showing it's actually good. It has no science. We're showing it has abundant science. But they had the power until we no longer trust them, until we no longer support them, until we no longer give them money, until we no longer go to them as our resource and instead choose other resources to go to. So I want to show you, up there is my biographical information that they put there without me asking, without me having anything to do with it. All wrong, and they did it for a reason. It is my personal belief that they put it up there so they could try to dissuade people from wanting to believe in me, listen to me, read my books, even publish. But fortunately, I've been around a lot longer than Wikipedia, and I have a very large audience that I've helped. So then people are stuck with the idea, if you've been listening to Gary Nall and you've been benefited from it, who do you believe? The skeptics who have no background, expertise, or skill in what he is an expert on, or them and their biases? Go up there and read it. Download it. You have their statements and my deconstructing every single sentence they've written about me and showing that what's wrong about it and the truth. And then you'll see, wow, we didn't know it could be this bad. It is. Unfortunately, of all the other people they've done the same thing to, they do not have forms to challenge. I do. So we're challenging now, not just on my behalf, because I'll be all right with or without Wikipedia, but all the other people who, unfortunately, they have been damaged to a level that they'll spend the rest of their life and never be able to get credibility they deserve. So that's one of the reasons over the next year, Wikipedia and Jimmy Wells, the co-founder, will see what the truth is coming from not the skeptics or the quackbusters, but rather from real science and health. Back in a moment, we're going directly into blowback. Israel creating Hamas that now it's bombing.
Yeah. Palestinian militant group Hamas has carried out brutal acts of terror against Israeli civilians. And Israeli and American leaders are always keen to tell us how dangerous and evil Hamas is.
The inhumanity of Hamas.
I have no sympathy for Hamas.
That keep shelling Israel with thousands of rockets and mortar shells.
But what if I told you that Israel helped create Hamas? Officially, Hamas, which is the acronym for an Arabic phrase meaning Islamic Resistance Movement, was founded in 1987, at the start of the first Palestinian Intifada, or uprising, against the Israeli occupation. But its roots were planted much earlier. The Hamas founder, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, was a half-blind, disabled Palestinian cleric and member of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood had been repressed by the Egyptians in Gaza prior to 1967. But once the Israelis invaded and occupied the Strip, they didn't just turn a blind eye to these Islamists. They encouraged them. See, the Israelis, especially right-wing Israelis, wanted to undermine the power of the dominant Palestinian political force at that time, the nationalist PLO, at the heart of which was the secular Fatah party of Yasser Arafat, their bête noire. By empowering Sheikh Yassin and the Muslim Brotherhood, Israeli leaders thought they could divide and rule the occupied Palestinians, play them off against each other, secular nationalists against religious Islamists. So in 1978, when Yassin wanted to officially register his Islamic Association, which was basically the precursor to Hamas, the Israelis were only too keen to help. Yassin built and grew a network of Islamist social institutions across Gaza, including schools and clubs and mosques, and Israel helped fund some of those projects. Most American politicians have no clue about any of this, although the former Republican Congressman Ron Paul once made this point on the floor of the House.
Hamas was encouraged and really started by Israel because they wanted Hamas to counteract Yasser Arafat.
Arafat himself told an Italian newspaper, quote, Hamas is a creature of Israel. He even claimed that former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin admitted as much to him, calling it a fatal error. Now, you might be wondering, why should I believe mad Ron Paul or the famously shady Yasser Arafat? Well, you don't have to. You can believe top Israeli and US officials who've basically owned up to all this. Brigadier Yitzhak Segev, for example, who was the Israeli military governor in Gaza, and later told a New York Times reporter that he helped finance the Islamic movement. The Israeli government gave me a budget, he said, and the military government gives to the mosques. Colonel David Hakam, who worked in Gaza in the late 1980s as an Arab affairs expert in the Israeli military, has admitted that the original sin was Israeli support for Yassin in the late 70s. But at the time, he has argued, nobody thought about the possible results. Well, Avner Cohen did. Cohen was the Israeli official who was responsible for religious affairs in Gaza for more than two decades, and who now says, quote, Hamas, to my great regret, is Israel's creation. Yeah, Cohen's words. He actually wrote an official report to his superiors in the mid-1980s, warning them not to play divide and rule in the occupied territories and calling on Israel to, quote, break up this monster before this reality jumps in our face. But no one else on the Israeli side really took the possibility of blowback seriously at that time. They never do, do they? Hamas has since killed far more Israeli civilians than any secular Palestinian militant group, and its leaders have been pretty viciously anti-Israeli and even anti-Semitic in their rhetoric. Sheikh Yassin would eventually be assassinated by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza.
Sheikh Yassin and its organization, the Hamas, are responsible to the killings of more than 400 Israelis. So the question shouldn't be why now. I think it should be why not before.
Why not before? Well, because before, Israel was actually nudging and winking at Yassin and co, building them up as a rival to Arafat's Fatah. The die was cast for blowback. Blowback, incidentally, that they decided to double down on when they assassinated Yassin.
You can hear the crowds chanting for Hamas, and any idea that this operation would actually suppress or diminish that organization seems to be ill-judged.
The inconvenient truth is that Hamas is in part a creature of Israel's own making, an enemy that Israel spent more than 20 years helping to build up, and then spent the next 20 years, the past 20 years that is, trying to bomb, besiege and blockade out of existence. The three Gaza wars, fought by Israel against Hamas since 2008, killed around 2,000 Palestinian civilians and a dozen Israeli civilians. That's the real human cost of blowback. David Long, a former Middle East expert at the US State Department under Ronald Reagan, told journalist Robert Dreyfus, "I thought the Israelis were playing with fire. I didn't realize they'd end up creating a monster. But I don't think you ought to mess around with potential fanatics. It's a lesson both the Israelis and the Americans never seem to learn, though. And as usual, innocent people, in this case Palestinians and Israelis, continue to lose their lives as a result."
Now, I'm going to ask you to give some thought to this, because this is not discussed anywhere else in the media. The United States has been supporting terrorist groups all along. We supported them in the Balkans, in Chechnya, against Russia. By the way, that was a Hussein just now. They supported the United States and the CIA, with the full support of the White House and national security agencies, have been supporting multiple terrorist groups, as has Saudi Arabia and Turkey, United Arab Emirates, all working together. And these terrorist groups are fighting in Yemen as we speak, with the United States soldiers on the ground, in Syria, in Gaddafi's Libya. And so why is it that the media has never once talked about the hypocrisy of us funding a war against terrorists, but then supporting those same terrorists with our weapons? And also, now we're going to be faced with blowback. Now that Syria has been substantially liberated by Syria, not the United States, and Russia, and Iran, now you're going to have all those thousands of terrorists going into other countries, Afghanistan, into Africa, and Mali, and the Sudan. And they're going to take all those weapons with them, our weapons. In fact, it's been shown that Israeli weapons and American weapons, whole warehouses of weapons with our money, taxpayer money paying for it, not a word, not one article, not one question at any press conference about how do we justify this. So you got two issues. One, supporting terrorists when we're supposed to be fighting them. And two, blowback. What happens when you can't control those terrorists and all those up to $1 billion we've spent, then we've funded them for a generation to come back against us. I'd like your thoughts. 888-874-4888 is our talkback number. Now, this is a short clip, only 60 seconds long, and it's just asking a question. No, I don't see it up on my board, so we're going to hear from Native Americans. These are all Native Americans. Some like just to be called Natives because they preceded America, and others like to be called Native Nation. But here are their voices collectively of how Americans have been brainwashed in thinking about the Native Americans and how invisible they are in our society, in our everyday lives.
I'm Apache, but really that's the government's name because they can't say Tsetsikai in there.
They will tell me how awesome they think it is that I've decided to be a part of my culture. And it's funny to me, it hits me really weird and I don't like it and I didn't know why at first, but it's because I haven't decided to be a part of my culture, I live it every day.
I'm more comfortable with the term Native, divorced from Native American. I know there are people who use Indigenous, and if there is one term I do not like to be called, is American Indian.
And for me, to be Indigenous is to have an intimate and interconnected relationship to a homeland.
And so that's really important because land is, you know, tied to every aspect of who we are.
Being native in a city is almost a daily reminder of your people's erasure, of the fact that people don't even remember that you're here and that you exist.
But what I did encounter was just this preconceived notion that all Native Americans are dead.
I've had older white men come up to me and say, oh man, if this was 40 years ago, I can just do whatever I wanted to you.
You know, the cattle outside doing the work and the dog inside the house, those are property. Those are the black folks in America. They're our property to white men. Then the exotic antelope on the wall, or the exotic, you know, that's the native, that's how natives are perceived in America.
We're treated like animals. They monitor our blood quantum. We're the only, I mean, besides dogs and horses, I don't know of any other animal that they monitor the blood quantum.
The way I explain it to people is like, imagine a pizza with different slices, and let's say 32 slices. Of the 32 slices, I'm 28 Apache. That's my particular blood quantum. And Native Americans in the U.S. are the only minority group who have to prove their nativeness on an Indian card.
It's used to divide Native people against each other, because it can be used as a way to say, I am more Native than you, and I was a part of that too. I used my 4/4ths to kind of make myself feel better against other people.
The one drop rule, meaning that, you know, one drop of black blood makes you black, you know, that was to keep as many people oppressed, or, you know, legitimize their oppression as possible. But on the other side, one drop of anything else completely dilutes you as a Native person. So if you're a Native person, you have a one drop of something else, then suddenly you're less Native. So it's the opposite.
Traditionally, within the Apache society, you go by the mother. And if the mother's recognized as Apache, she has her clan, the children are unquestionably Apache. Not in the American context, not when patriarchy trumps matriarchy. So what does that mean? My sisters are short 1/16th of a degree. What does that mean? Does that mean their pinkies aren't Apache? What does that mean?
You know, being a mixed race person is a whole another side of it, but that's a very common experience in our tribe. So it's not as if we're unusual in that way. What is unusual is the admixture of black.
My grandfather actually doesn't want people, if he hears that somebody from the tribe is coming over, he won't come out of his room, because he doesn't want them to know that he's that complexion. That he doesn't, I guess he doesn't want me to be affiliated with having African-American blood, but I mean, I say it. It's not gonna change anything.
If it were up to the American government, natives wouldn't be around, because after a certain time, that blood will dilute. It will go out. And so if there's no native peoples to provide benefits, then we're not obligated to meet these treaty rights. And if we're not obligated to meet these treaty contracts, then the land is available. The resources are available.
And I think that essential point about our claim to sovereignty, our claim to land, our claim to a culture, our claim to resources, is one that gets lost if we don't insist upon the fact that we are nations.
And we have taken huge steps to decolonizing, and that proof comes from people being able to have the opportunities to speak their language, to be on their ancestral land.
But the thing with decolonization is that it's an ongoing process, just like grieving, just like any loss.
As much as possible now, I try to tell people that I have a Native American name, and maybe it doesn't mean anything to you, but it means everything to me. My name maybe doesn't have a romanticized Hollywood Indian name, but my name has more meaning than that. My name means that my family survived. My family survived disease. My family survived Catholicism. My family survived settler colonialism, colonism, and my family, they survived. I survived. My existence is resistance. Me saying my name is Skiam Tulks, that is resistance in and of itself.
just some voices from those who survive, but for all intents and purposes are invisible. And so I just want to do something. So this summer I'm going to be traveling to about 27 different tribes, filming the elders to talk about the message they have, that they've given to the younger people, and that they have for those who are not aware of their culture, their traditions, or the importance of this moment of understanding what all of these natives could share with us that could help us in our crisis. So it'll be coming next fall, but I'll be doing it this summer. Before we go to our guest, we're going to play one more audio clip, and this is about the state is collecting data on our kids and using it to brainwash them.
The data shows that students have beliefs or attitudes that some teacher or bureaucrat doesn't like. There's not much to stop them from creating a curriculum aimed at altering our kids' beliefs and attitudes, and the data will help them do it. A world where the government decides what thoughts are acceptable and molds children to comply and follow the rules. Think it can't happen in your school district? Think again.
Just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we find a woman who courageously and relentlessly stood up to her local school district.
When you find out that they're scoring, the government is scoring the attitudes and values of the personality of your child, then that's a violation of your freedom.
Meet Anita Hoag, proud mother, education consultant, and national speaker. She's been a parent advocate fighting for student privacy since her son came home from school confused about a question on a school test.
If you saw an old lady standing on the side of the street, what would you do? A, push her in the street, or B, throw rocks at her?
Seemed like an odd question, so she asked for more from the school than the district. And finally, Hoag filed a federal complaint to see the test. It took 4 years, but she finally got it.
The government was scoring the attitudes and values of our children. It's a violation of privacy.
She described it as a reward and punishment agenda where the government decides what constitutes positive behavior. Take this question. There's a secret club at school called the Midnight Artists. They go out late at night and paint funny sayings and pictures on buildings. In this situation, would I join the club when I knew my parents would ground me if they found out?
First of all, it's a vandalism situation, and the child is to role play that would they join the club or not. The state desired response is no. And I thought, okay, so if this is a total compliance thing, why would they want me to obey my parents instead of going out to vandalize? Well, it's because what was the government looking for? If punishment is incurred, will you obey?
Hoag paints a bleak picture of a system that could turn our children into perfect human capital. Each child urged toward a specific career path to benefit the collective economy, not necessarily to pursue his or her own individual happiness and freedom.
If you have a system that's collecting personal data and sharing personal data, and making decisions on personal data, what do you have? So it's a psychometric dossier is what we have. But what they do with the data is the most important thing. So if we're changing the behavior, the attitudes, values, dispositions of children, yeah, it's brainwashing.
I'll be continuing with an in-depth commentary with Professor Daniel DeNicola, professor and chair of the philosophy at a major Pennsylvania school on Friday. And the issue is, do you have a right to believe whatever you want to? Well, for many, the answer would be yes. But then, yes in some areas and more challenged in others. It'll be a very interesting discussion. But I'm very concerned when our schools begin to collect that on children's perceptions and behavior with those perceptions to mold a curriculum where the child will be a completely compliant and obedient citizen. Very concerned about that. My guest is online now. She's from the Hudson Valley, Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She is a investigative journalist. For the past 5 years, she has become the nation's leading reporter on Lyme's disease, and she's attracted quite a lot of attention and also won 7 awards for her groundbreaking articles. And she has written a book called Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. And Jane Goodall and Bill McKibben and others have given their input on this and are supportive. Nice to have you with us today, Mary Beth.
Thanks so much for having me, Gary.
On occasion, I've brought on guests to speak about Lyme's disease. However, it's turning into a global issue. It's a scourge, and it's receiving negligible attention. And recently, an international team of researchers found that despite antibiotic therapy, which is the first line of treatment after getting a tick bite and showing a reddish rash, infection can remain persistent in a growing number of people. And to give an idea of these, and that these are extremely conservative figures, the CDC claims Lyme disease is 6 times more common than AIDS, 20 times more common than hepatitis C, 30 times, that's 3,000% more common than tuberculosis. But more worrisome is the denial of the government and the entire conventional medical establishment, including the insurance industry, and confronting the real cost of the disease. When it first appeared, it was linked to the northeastern United States. Now Lyme is global. It was even found in ticks in parks in London. And since listeners have heard about Lyme and know it is a tick-borne disease, please summarize what the Lyme organism is and what are the more accurate statistics of its prevalence and spread, and how much has it been increasing in the United States in recent years?
Well, Lyme disease is growing not only in the United States, but globally. It is a very serious problem that basically is being pushed around the planet on climate change. Ticks are moving up latitudes. They're climbing mountains. They are thriving in places that were once too cold for them to live. And what these ticks carry in their guts are pretty concerning organisms, pathogens. The leading one, of course, is the one that causes Lyme disease. It's called Borrelia burgdorferi. That little tick that you brush up against when you are at the edge of a trail and there's a little bit of high grass and so forth, climbs onto you. It has very, very magical talents, if you will. When the tick begins to bite you, it puts out a numbing agent, so you don't actually feel the bite. It has something in its saliva that is an anticoagulant, so the blood can flow from you into the tick's gut. It then begins to proceed to unload its lethal cargo, or its certainly damaging cargo, in the form of these assorted pathogens, Borrelia being the first. It takes probably, some say 24 hours. The medical literature pretty much maintains it's more like 36, 48 hours before you become infected by this tick. But the tick is exceedingly small in its most dangerous life stage. Ticks have 3 life stages, and it's the middle one, when it's a nymph, that it already has likely bit a mouse, become infected, and then goes on to infect human beings if it's lucky enough to find one pass by. And when we become infected with Lyme disease, what ordinarily happens, or might happen really if you're lucky, is you get a Lyme disease rash. It's reddish often. It may have a central clearing. That's why it's called the bullseye rash. But it also may present in a lot of different ways. It may be a little bit bumpy, a little blistery, have a very irregular pattern. It may not be recognized for what it is, namely the Lyme disease rash. And this is where we get into the sticky problems of Lyme disease. Lyme disease has been framed for a very long time as being easy to diagnose and easy to treat. And the whole premise of being easy to diagnose rests on two prongs. The first is, oh, you get the rash. We can tell you're infected because you have the rash. But only 70% of people, and that is a high number. Other studies put it at much lower. But I'll accept the CDC's 70% figure. That means that 30% don't get that rash, that tell their doctor they're infected and they need treatment and they need it right away. For those other 30%, they may go to the doctor. They don't feel well. They may have flu-like symptoms. This is what initially happens when you're infected with Lyme disease, chills, fever, headache. And the doctor may say, well, we'll take a test. 30 to 40% of the time, you're going to test correctly positive. The rest of the time, the 60 to 70% of the time, you are going to be a false negative. So you flunk the test. You have the disease, but you don't pass. And the guidelines that have long dictated how Lyme disease is treated in the United States, and by extension, because of the power of American medicine around the world, say that you must have either that rash or the positive test in order to be treated. So your doctor says to you, go home, you're not sick, you haven't tested positive yet, but come back a little bit later if you're still feeling poorly and we'll retest you. And as the weeks passed, as a month or two passes, the test does indeed get better. But it isn't until the late disseminated stage, when that organism has moved potentially throughout your body, that this test really performs its best, 90% to 100% accuracy. But even then, when I say 90%, I mean 1 in 10 cases still can be missed at that stage of the disease. And, you know, this is one organism you do not want to let loose, you do not want to let fester in the human body. Just like the ticks have these kinds of magical powers, the Lyme disease spirochete, which basically is a corkscrew-shaped organism, can really do some damage to the human body. It, because it's that corkscrew shape, because it has this internal mechanism, flagella, that enables it sort of to drill through tough cartilage and muscle and organ tissue, it really can get into some places in the human body that are tough for antibiotics to reach. It can cross the blood-brain barrier. It can get into the eyes and cause eye problems. It can get into the heart and cause Lyme carditis. We had in this area of the Hudson Valley a 17-year-old boy who collapsed from Lyme carditis and died. He, by the way, had been tested for Lyme disease, and he tested negative, wrongly negative. So this is something we really need to pay attention to. We have for too long minimized this disease, which sort of brings me to the second part of this equation, and that is the treatment part of Lyme disease. When you get the rash, when you're treated quickly, you have a very, very good chance of being okay. And the entire dogma of Lyme disease is really built on those early, easy-to-diagnose cases. But the other people, the people who are treated belatedly, the people who don't test positive according to this regime, the people who don't have the rash, these are often the people that go on to develop significant and long-term problems from Lyme disease. All right, you present to the doctor, you have Lyme disease, you are given a course of antibiotics. You take it maybe 10 to 28 days. The medical mainstream, the guidelines that say to doctors, this is the way you treat Lyme disease, maintain that after that short course of antibiotics, the Lyme disease pathogen is dead. It is killed in your body. End of story. You no longer have Lyme disease. Okay, that's what we say on one side. But on the other side, even the medical mainstream, even the people who wrote these guidelines and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control that accept these guidelines and have long endorsed them, they accept that 10 to 20% of people who are treated early, who are treated exactly as these guidelines maintain, will remain ill for some period of time afterward, for weeks, for months, and possibly for years. Now, if you take that 10 to 20% figure, we're talking about 30 to 60,000 people a year who are treated for Lyme disease in America who will remain ill afterward. That is huge, but it's a problem that is dismissed by the powers that be. They say, we have killed the Lyme spirochete in your body with antibiotics. End of story. If you continue to have problems, that's not our responsibility. It's somebody else who has to take care of this. What I maintain is in my book is that this huge population of people have essentially been abandoned by medicine. And I would also add here that there was another more recent study, and it involved people who were treated early for Lyme disease. They were tracked from 11 to 20 years, a very long period of time to study these folks who had Lyme disease. And at the end of this study, they found, this one study found that 5% still had symptoms of Lyme disease and lingering problems an average of 15 years later. That's an amazing number, because if you take that 5% of people, which is 15,000 a year, multiply it year by year by year, this is no small thing. 15 years later that people are going to have these symptoms. And, you know, when that study came out, it was published in Clinical Infectious Diseases Journal. And it was actually framed, and this kind of blows my mind, as good news. Here we found that only, and it did say it, only 5% had lingering symptoms. And an editorial ran.
Mary Beth, I need to. Yes. We're coming up near the end of our segment. I want to emphasize two things.
Good.
First, for those of us who live on farms or ranches, and I've lived on either a farm or ranch my entire adult life, never came down with tick bites for a simple reason.
Mm-hmm.
A, I wear white socks outside of my pants, so that if I do get a tick on me, I can see it. B, I cover my ground, even 30, 40, 50 acres, with diatomaceous earth. And I have found that is the best way of killing ticks. And I know people in suburban areas who have gotten Lyme disease from ticks, because the ticks are everywhere now. One moose, I was told that today, had over 100,000 ticks on its body, and it died. So prevention is very important. And when people go into the woods, which they should just be conscious that the ticks you're not going to be able to see most often. You're walking through a property that shrubs and tall grass. That's where it frequently can come, but it also can come on you on a beach. I remember going to Jones Beach and spreading out a big white sheet, and some people were there with me. Said, "Why the sheet?" And I said, "Because in case ticks." And they laughed at me. Three ticks we saw on that sheet within an hour. Three. So that's one thing. You can use diatomaceous earth, which is inexpensive. You got to put it down when the weather's dry, not when it's wet. But it's a fossilized material, and it lances the bodies of spiders, ticks, and insects. That's one. And it also, my dogs don't have any ticks either for the same reason. They're out running around all day long. And I would do it. I might have to apply it once a week, but it's worth it. Two, for those of us who are in alternative principles of healing, we have seen that homeopathic zeolites, ozone, intravenous ozone, and intravenous vitamin C followed by natural antibiotics. And there's at least 12 natural antibiotics that support the gut biome instead of destroying it are very important for those who want to look at least an alternative way of doing it. And unfortunately, almost everyone taking antibiotics, these courses, and especially if it's a repeat course, they're destroying the good bacteria and making their body susceptible to other diseases. So there is a natural, non-toxic approach. We don't have time today, but on an upcoming program, I will give the natural protocol for Lyme's disease because I've had some remarkable results reversing Lyme's disease in these people. Final thought before we end.
Yes, I agree with all of that. In fact, I took a couple of natural antibiotics when I had a case of Lyme disease, caught early, treated quickly with traditional antibiotics, but I did follow up with something called Cemento and Banderol, which have been found to be effective against Lyme disease. And you're right, Gary. Prevention is extremely important in this equation. And government has done precious little to prevent the spread of these ticks or to control the spread of these ticks. We have something in Texas called the cattle tick, which carries sometimes a disease called bovine babesiosis. Well, when that breaks out among the cattle in Texas, because it's a cash cow, quite literally, there's quarantines, there's millions of dollars spent. We dip the cows in this solution to get the ticks off them, on and on. We have yet to really try to really put our minds to figure out how to stop this epidemic. And these ticks are, as you have noted, breeding profusely, turning up all over the place. A simple walk through a lovely field with a child, I have grandkids, is tinged with fear. And, I am teaching my grandchildren to fear, in a sense, nature. We really need to do these things, unfortunately, because of the impact of Lyme disease on people.
Mary, one last thing, then we got to go. Mm-hmm. I'm fortunate enough to have some little creatures, possums, and possums are the single best way of killing ticks on a property. They're immune to Lyme's disease, and they are voracious eaters. They eat all the ticks they can find all day long, and they're not harmful to humans, so don't kill a possum. If you ever come across a possum, realize the possum's killing the ticks for you. We got to go, Mary Beth. Thank you very much. Yes. And good luck on the book. And hopefully people read Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change by Mary Beth Pfeiffer. Nice to have you with us, Mary.
Thank you, Gary.